David Amram, Ruthie.
This is wonderful.
And I played at his 80th birthday party.
David, okay. ¿Cómo aprendiste a hablar español? Repítame eso otra vez.
Oh, gracias. Aprendí el español en la calle en Nueva York con los músicos latinos porque toqué con Mario Bausa y Machito y Tito Puente en 67 en Teatro de Bahía en Cuba con Arturo Sandoval, Paquito de Rivera y Los Papinas. Estuve muchas veces en América Central.
For our English-speaking audience, I'd like to introduce... For the English-speaking audience, I'd like to introduce David Amram, a dear friend of mine, who I played at his 80th birthday party at Symphony Hall. And it seemed like anybody that had picked up a string or a horn or a percussion instrument has played with David. David himself has played with, well, David, you like to call me Pops. And I said, why? And you said, that's what Dizzy called you. And I didn't know if you meant the baseball player or the other guy. What is your background, David? Can you do that in a nutshell? Is there a nut big enough?
Sure. Well, I was born in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, brought up on a farm in Feasterville, Pennsylvania, population 200. My uncle was a merchant seaman, took me to hear the Philadelphia Orchestra at 7, to hear Duke Ellington at 10, then took me down to New Orleans when I was about 14, and my life was set.
And over the years, David Amram has had his music conducted by Leonard Bernstein at Carnegie Hall. He did the score for The Manchurian Candidate in the 60s, a landmark film score that was jazz-based. He's known as a French horn virtuoso. He plays virtually any percussion instrument, and I featured him on the Steve Martin album, The Crow, a record that I produced. And David, thank you for helping that album win a Grammy. But what are you doing right now?
Well, I'm about to go to the Montpelier, Vermont, speaking of putting the pedal to the metal, from my little farm upstate to see the sneak preview of a new film called David Amram, The First 80 Years. And it's a series of all concerts I've done with symphonies, jazz, Latin, Native American, traditional Irish, where you were gracious enough to play with us and knock everybody out. All the different kinds of musics I've been blessed to do all of my life, and all those different styles and idioms end up in my symphonic pieces because they're things that I know how to play and that I love and that I respect.
Did you write any music with Jack Kerouac or just travel with him? Did he write lyrics for your music that you came up with?
Well, we did one song called Pull My Daisy with lyrics by Jack, his road buddy Neil Cassidy, and Allen Ginsberg for a short film in 1959. But all the rest of the time, I was his first musical accompanist. 1957, we did the first ever jazz poetry readings in New York. We never rehearsed once, and for that, I never wrote down anything. I just listened to him at the moment and tried to figure out what I could play that would enhance the music that was already in those beautiful words of his.
Now, when David talks about play, for you, those of you listening, I have a song that I named Acoustic Traveler that I played with him once, and we did it live on radio, and it was absolutely beautiful. He was playing the penny whistle, or the, what is that whistle, that flute?
Yeah, the Irish penny whistles.
Yeah, and then about 3 weeks later, we did it again. Now, the once that we did it was in the key of C minor. I didn't realize the next time that I'd put my guitar capo on the second fret instead of the third fret, which meant that I was now playing in B minor. And we didn't rehearse it, and David played it like he wrote it. And I didn't hear anything funny go by. And he said, that was a little different when we were done. And I said, oh, I did it in a different key. I did it a half step flat. David, you're truly one of America's musical. It's hard for somebody to be called a genius often. And I know you, but you know that you're extremely gifted. How long did you play with Dizzy Gillespie and what? In Cuba?
Well, I met him in 1951 when I was a 20-year-old hayseed living in a basement apartment in Washington, D.C. He befriended me, and I played with him off and on until he passed away. He was the most magnificent person, teacher, scholar, ambassador for music, more fun than anyone that ever lived. One of the smartest, lovely, caring, spiritual people you'd ever want to meet. And when people seeing him in public, that's exactly what he was like. What he appeared to be was what he was like. Just like Willie Nelson and yourself and a lot of other people, what they were like on stage is what they were like off stage. They were real.
You mentioned Willie Nelson. You've played with Willie and Pete Seeger and Arlo, a whole different world than the classical world that you were actually kind of bred into or worked in a lot. What is that like, and when have you played with Willie?
I played almost every Farm Aid, and it was even on one of his records when he played at the Irving Plaza, and I was just sitting in, and sure enough, Mickey Rayfield called up and said, "Dave, you're on the record." Willie's just a magnificent person, great musician, and again, just a joy to be with on every level. And I feel blessed that all these different musicians I have worked with, and a lot of young people who no one's ever heard of, who are terrific, make everything else in life worthwhile.
One of my favorite Willie Nelson comments is maybe 15 years ago, Barbara Walters was interviewing him and said, "Willie, why do you do this?" Because he didn't have to do it. He's written so many hit songs, he's made a lot of money from that. And he said, "I just love to hear old Willie sing."
Well, he told me something, John, and I wrote it in my last book, Upbeat Nine Lives of a Musical Cat, because I wanted to quote him. I just said, "Willie, every time we play Farm Aid, you make it all about the farmers. You're gracious to every musician, every fan, every old and young person that crosses your path. And you're just a great musician's musician. It's an honor just to be with you. It makes me feel good for a month afterwards." Mm-hmm. And he said, "Dave, I'm a lucky guy. Doing what I love to do and able to do it."
Yeah. For people that don't know, Willie probably plays golf 5 days a week and rides his bike that he carries on the bus when he goes to a concert. And he plays the guitar. He's one of my favorite guitar players. He backs himself up better than anybody.
He's wonderful. And his band is wonderful.
David, why do you do this?
Well, I love doing it so much. That's really the same thing that Dizzy said to me on the boat to Cuba in 1977. He was interviewed by the New York Times and they said, "Well, Mr. Gillespie, what are you going to do when you retire?" He said, "I'll never retire." He said, "I'm doing what God put me here to do, to play this music." And that's the way I feel as far as composing and trying to share the music with other people, to show young people that you can do what you love to do for other people and with other people, and that it makes you happier and healthier to be able to do that than anything else. So you got to go the other direction.
Well, we're talking with David Amram, one of the hip behind-the-scenes musicians, in my mind, one that so many people know, and they always feel lucky to have him play either Irish tin whistle or piano or percussion instruments, but not just a musician, you're a writer. What are some of the symphonic things that you've written?
Well, that's really my forte. My symphonic variations on a song by Woody Guthrie was commissioned by the Guthrie Foundation. That's going to get played by orchestras all over the country for Woody's 100th birthday a year and from now in 2012. And my new piano concerto, one of my best pieces, and I finished that when I was 79. So my hope is that young people will see that if you want to be a composer, you just keep on trucking and keep on writing the music, and eventually it will get heard. A lot of the things that are being played now on recorder are things that I wrote 30 and 40 years ago, and I'm still doing it. I have over 100 pieces that I've written, and I'm writing two new pieces at the moment, and I love doing it. And my son said, "Dad, if nothing else, you have a good attitude."
Attitude?
Yeah, and the attitude is what you really need to keep being creative, to never get discouraged. And with YouTube, young people today can escape what I call incarceration in that penitentiary of bad taste, and they can see the masters of every genre of music built to last on YouTube. from Clifford Brown and Charlie Parker to Kalsum to Patsy Cline to John McEwen, some 12-year-old genius reading a poem or playing a song, and then turn off the computer and find out that there's young people all over this country who are creating wonderful music, songs, poetry, dance, theater, visual arts, and literature, and we are not going to go away. We're here for the duration, and we can see that we don't have to feel isolated and persecuted and depressed, because there's a whole army of creative people out there, better informed than ever. And with the internet, it's possible to bypass and go beyond and see all the beauty that's always been out there.
David, you mentioned with the internet, and you're quite an avid user of cell phone internet. I mean, we're Skyping right now.
And it's beautiful.
And for those that are either just tuning in or listening, David is 80 years old and proud of it. And you're about the oldest teenager I know. Your energy level is very high because you're that type of person. You like to make things, but you're not afraid of computers and the internet.
No. Well, I told my son, since I've fortunately followed trying to be a jazz French horn player, trying to be a symphony composer, writing tonal music, using Native American, Latin American, African American, Irish, and Middle Eastern music and symphony pieces was a complete waste of time. Everything that I've done, backing up poets, everything that I've done, I was told, that's not what to do. And fortunately, having done that, I've built an incredible life doing what I love to do. So I told my son, Adam, who's in Japan, I just Skyped him an hour ago, and my daughter, who's out on the road with her country band, and my other daughter, who lives in Brooklyn, I told them all, I promised them, I said, Dad, got to slow down. You're driving like 600 miles just this weekend. I said, well, I made a promise to them when I turn 90, that gives me 10 more years. If I don't really hit the big time, I'm going to go to dental school. And I told my dentist that. And he said, well, Mr. Amram, if you live that long, I think you'd make a very good dentist. So that gives me 10 more years, John, to play with you anytime and every time, anywhere.
As far as playing, I got a question. You have quite a broad past of pastiche, quite a broad bunch of people you've played with. Is there any one particular memory, like going to Cuba with Dizzy Gillespie or playing at Carnegie Hall? How many times have you played Carnegie?
Well, I played there a bunch of times, and I always enjoy it, and I never felt nervous. I felt more at home. I said, man, this is where Tchaikovsky conducted when he came to America.
Did you conduct there?
Yes, I conducted first in 1966, a piece that I wrote, a Jewish Friday night sacred service called Shir LaRev Shabbat, and it was a whole program sponsored by the Catholic Church of all religions coming together, and they had the jazz mass by Mary Lou Williams. Before that, it had a different title called Music for Peace, and by coincidence, I played on that original recording with her, and they had all kinds of religious music from all over the world, and I had a wonderful chorus and an organ and a great singer, and it was just such a thrill just to be there. It's such a beautiful, beautiful place. It's such a warm sound. And when I played with Charles Mingus at the old Cafe Bohemia, 1955, my first gig in New York, Mingus said to me, man, no matter how ratty the joint, every night with me is Carnegie Hall.
I know what he means. I always tell people, this is going to be my best show. And they say, well, what do you mean? I says, because it could be my last one, and it's going to be the best I can do, because I don't want something. I saw his last show, you know. He was on the way out. He was on the way out anyway.
Well, one of my favorite memories of all the times we played together, and it's been a ball every time, was when we played at the pizza place in New Jersey. And when you did the thing where you were playing the guitar, it sounded like three people playing, and then you said, give the bass player a big hand. Somebody in the front eating a pizza said, my God, man, that's him playing that too. And all the things that you did that night, you turned that pizza place into a big-time Arts Center, and they didn't need to build a $40 million building.
David, this is about you, okay?
Oh. Well, that was my impression of a great John McEwen experience.
This isn't enough talk about me. Let's talk about you playing with me. That isn't the direction I was headed.
Yeah, it was really a pleasure. And one of the nice things is, on my 79th birthday, back in my teenage years, by an amazing coincidence, I remember you were playing at the winery in New York.
Well, City Winery, a great venue in New York, yes.
And you invited me to come and sit in. I said, well, man, that's great, because that's going to be at midnight. It'll actually be my birthday. So my kids came down, and it was so much fun. And I said, what a great way to start a new year.
David, I probably should have told you that I knew if I called you to play on your birthday, I wouldn't have to pay you.
Well, that was my birthday present.
It's fair. I played on your 80th the next year, and you didn't pay me. So there.
I was hoping you wouldn't tell anybody that.
It was a trade-out. But after all these years and combinations of people that have been vast that you've accompanied, are there a couple that stand out, say, besides Dizzy Gillespie and Jack Kerouac?
Yes, I would say certainly when I played for Betty Carter, the great jazz singer, we had a whole classical orchestra. And my job was to accompany her extraordinary singing with her trio with the orchestra, where the orchestra would fit in and not overwhelm her.
Did you have to write the score for that music?
Well, what I did was I took some of the arrangements and kind of redid them so that there wouldn't be too much stuff happening to interfere with what was already there. Because as we all know, less is more. And the big struggle in music, whether you're composing, conducting, playing, writing, accompanying, soloing, is to try to know what to leave out. And working with Betty was just such a thrill. She was such a consummate artist. I loved doing that. And I play very often now for John Ventimiglia, the wonderful actor in The Sopranos. He's probably the best Kerouac reader since Kerouac. And when he reads anything, not just Kerouac, but any kind of poetry, and I accompany him, I just enjoy being in that role of being a backup player. And if you can do that, then when you're a soloist or when you're conducting or when you're writing a symphony, you learn how not to drown out other people and how to restrain yourself and get a larger picture. That's why it's good, I think, for everybody in music and in life to have the different roles that we have. When we played with Levon Helm that night at the Ramble, that was an extraordinary experience, playing with you and then sitting in with his band.
Yeah, I remember his band. I asked the band leader, Larry Campbell, I said, do I need to go over the songs I'm going to do with you guys with the piano player? What's his name? He goes, oh, his name's Donald Fagen. And I just said, oh, never mind. For those who don't know Donald Fagen, you can look him up. As I suggest, you look up David Amram's broad, varied, rich career. Just David Amram, Google him. What is your website, David? Do you have one?
Yes, it's davidamram.com. DavidAmram.
Uh-huh. All right. Do you have any current music, like a recent release or book?
My three books keep coming out, amazingly enough. I have a wonderful publisher in Boulder. I have everything out and available, which is extraordinary. So when people come up and asked me to sign something, I'm shocked that it wasn't someone that I gave the copy to myself. So my three books are Vibrations, which has come out again, the 68, and Offbeat collaborated with Kerouac, and Upbeat, Nine Lives of a Musical Cat. And they're all,
what is that again? Upbeat?
Yeah, Upbeat, Nine Lives of a Musical Cat.
By David Amram.
Yes, and I'm going to...
I read that book, David, and I feel like you're writing... although it is novel. But if somebody wants to know what it's like to be with David Amram, get that book. You'll see what it's like to be this itinerant, wandering musician. You should be musician without borders. That's what you are. You play with every style. Your music score for The Manchurian Candidate was, I guess, considered a jazz score, right?
Well, yes and no, because I orchestrated everything myself, and we had a whole symphony there, too. It used jazz and modern European-oriented classical music, And because I did everything myself and didn't use ghostwriters, orchestrators, computers, a composer, as serious doing that as I was when I did Splendor in the Grass way back before that, and when I wrote my last symphony and my violin concerto and all the other, my two operas that I've done, all of these things, everything should be beautiful and serious and as well done as possible. The new movie that we're doing, David Amram, The First 80 Years, is all about that. It's all different kinds of people and music's from all different genres, and it's quite amazing. Lawrence Krayman, who's the guy who dared to spend 2 years hanging out with me and filming everything, is someone who started his own little classical record company and actually put out some of my symphonic CDs, and he loves classical music. So everything in the film that's recorded is done from a classical point of view, where they try to make it sound like it does in real life. And that's what I love to hear in recordings, whether it's a bluegrass group or a jazz or a rock group or whatever, to know that you're hearing a document of what of the real thing, rather than something that's put in an attorney's office who never learned how to sing and dance or hear anything or play an instrument, and make it sound like it's done in the Holland Tunnel to make it supposedly more exciting or acceptable.
I got a question for you that you're only making a comment on your perception of what you've heard. And that's not necessarily a judgment. It's just an opinion. When you're playing things, do you know what you're going to play sometimes? Like when putting you on the Steve Martin album, there is this one little whistly instrument that was kind of shaped like a potato. And you went out and did something. You said, I got an idea for that. And you went out and played something in the first take that's on the record, as many things that you do are first take. In a situation like that, as a pretending I'm a non-musician, how do you explain that? Because I don't think you had the notes in your head. You weren't going, oh, I know what'll work. Da 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 da. You just knew you had something, and you went and played it. How does that happen?
I could hear it at the moment, John, and I would compare it, I hope, as favorably as I would compare what it was like to see Michael Jordan making one of those incredible baskets at the last minute, and then you watch the slow motion back and you say, how did he ever do that? And the reason is, it was at that moment, and when you saw Muhammad Ali knock out Sonny Liston in the Lewiston second fight, the phantom punch, and they said, he didn't even hit him. When you look at the replay about 10 times, you could see that it was done with such subterfuge. Sonny Liston didn't see it, and most of the audience didn't see it. And these are things that you see in sports, basketball. When you see Joe DiMaggio, he would run out and catch a ball. It was as if he wasn't even looking. He would just turn his back when he heard the bat hit and run and gracefully put his hand up at the right spot a ballet dancer.
Are you sometimes surprised when you play on a pass, an overdub, where the track has already been made and you're playing along with the tape to add a track? Are you sometimes surprised at what comes out?
Well, you hope that it will be something that will make it better than if you didn't show up. And seriously, that's a big thing in music and in life. Like when you're sitting down at a dinner with people and being friendly, you try to add something to the situation and not wreck it.
We've been talking with David Amram. You know that. People listening may not, but I'm awfully glad you showed up in my life. And what you do is an incredible amount of things that I suggest people go look at davidamram.com, check out the books, the music, the stories, and don't miss a performance, because it's an unusual American treasure that is David Amram. And I guess what I'm saying is, thanks for being with us.
Well, John, I sure thank you. And for all your listeners, keep listening to good music. Be creative. If you have kids, encourage them to be creative. Kids, if you're listening, get your parents and grandparents to come to your shows and hang out with you and support music and art in our schools and in our lives and have fun.
Well, thank you, David.
Oh, this was wonderful. This is actually American music history. I'm sitting here while you two are talking, looking at your musical history. You were playing with Johnny Depp.
Yeah.
Guitar.
Yeah, he's a good guitar player and a wonderful guy that loves.
He's a perfectionist. Yeah.
It wasn't just some egomaniac saying I'm a movie star and film me. He was a serious musician. Boy, it was beautiful to see that. You know, he was just as dedicated as we are to trying to do the right thing.
And you two play for each other's birthdays?
No, it was they're both his birthday at the City Winery in New York, where I knew it was his birthday, and I know him well enough to know that he'd rather be on stage than not.
I want to play for John's birthdays, but he's too young.
I don't know how Dave feels about it, but I don't have a job. I don't get up in the morning and say, I've got to go to work. I have concerts that I go do when they're on the calendar, but that's a different world. When I get up in the morning, I don't go in and get my guitar or banjo and say, hello, everybody. Hey, have you heard this one yet? Then there's nobody to play to. What am I going to do? I mean, tomorrow I'm going to go play at the deli on the corner with the three older guys that get together there on Friday morning, because I'd rather be playing with other people than sitting here on my own.
All right. Be sure to book me for the next one, John.
Okay.
At the deli.
Yeah. Hey, I got a free sandwich out of it.
Oh, I'm ready. All right.
Well, Ruthie, I'm going to go. And David, good luck up there with your film.
Oh, thank you. And Ruthie, it's a pleasure to talk to you. Gracias por la oportunidad de hablar español. Para aprender nunca es tarde. I did a program in Denver, and I told Ray Mantillo, who's this great conga player, I said, man, I'm doing a bilingual program. And he's from Puerto Rico. I said, man, he said, your Spanish is cool. But he said, how are them kids going to understand your English with that New York accent? I come to Orlando and Miami and all those places. I'm doing one with Candido and Bobby Sanabria to celebrate Candido's 90th birthday and Mario Bowser's 100th birthday at the Apollo Theater. That's going to really be something.
When is that?
That's in June at the Apollo Theater. It's on my webpage, on my calendar.
Excellent. That's the type of thing we want to know so that we can let our audience and get tickets.
Yeah, yeah, that's some incredible stuff. That they're celebrating how in the 40s the Latin jazz and Afro-Cuban music was all part of the same community and same spirit, and they're trying to kind of get that back again.
Oh, wonderful. That's wonderful.
Well, I'm going to beg off and continue doing stuff here.
John, I send you a big hug, give your wife a big kiss.
All right.
And I hope we get together soon.
Me too, David.
If you're free on that, April 4th, come down to the Cornelius Street Stadium. And I'm sure, as you told Ruthie, I'm what they call an equal opportunity career destroyer.
And don't forget, you can see David Amram in New York City doing one of his Cornelius Street Cafe shows. And folks, this is like going back to the beatnik days, the bohemian days with a great American artist in a very intimate cafe. And this is a guy that's, as you heard, played Carnegie Hall many times, has a documentary of his life, the first 80 years, coming out soon. It's a wonderful opportunity. Check out Cornelius Street Cafe in the Village, and the food's great there, too. On Monday, April 4th, in New York City, 8:30, the Cornelius Street Cafe. David Amram.
Yes, sir.
There we go. David, I'll talk to you down the road.
John, that was the best interview since the Gettysburg Address. Thanks. We've got to get a copy of that one.
Hasta luego.
Hasta luego.